Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, the critical need for organ donors, especially in minority communities. Over half of those waiting on transplant lists are people of color. And gardening expert Jenny Rose Carey is back. We'll ask her about salvaging plants hit hard by the recent heat. But first, the Inflation Reduction Act devotes $370 billion to climate and energy-friendly programs, including incentives to boost the affordability of electric cars and trucks. Getting many more EVs on the road is considered a critical step towards slowing the pace of global warming. According to the EPA, the transportation sector is responsible for 27% of all greenhouse gas emissions. Electric vehicles, or EVs, have no tailpipe emissions, and they tend to leave a relatively small carbon footprint. There is enormous consumer interest right now, and to begin the show, we're talking about tax credits and other incentives in the new measure to make purchasing these vehicles more affordable to a wide swath of the public. However, the rules are complex, so there might not be a mass rush to the dealer, at least immediately. Here with us now to help navigate is John Paul McDuffie, professor of management at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania and director of the Program on Vehicle and Mobility Innovation. Good to have you with us, John Paul.
Thank you, Mary. Good to be here.
So to start, give us your take on the Inflation Reduction Act and its effort to address the climate crisis. Significant step forward, in your opinion?
Oh, absolutely. I think the climate provisions in the bill are broad and comprehensive, and they do a lot to keep the momentum going towards clean energy in a variety of areas, including transportation, which I know is our focus today. It provides it mostly through investment incentives and credits of various kinds, whether to businesses, to investors in future projects, to homeowners or to vehicle purchasers. And I think it's going to help immensely move the U.S. towards some of these important emission reduction goals.
So speaking of electric vehicles, I think it's $7,500 for new EVs in tax credits, $4,000 for used models. When do these credits go into effect? And we should say, too, that President Biden is expected to sign the act into law this week sometime.
Right. I think there is already the tax credit of $7,500, and that will remain in effect until the end of 2022 under current rules, and then the new rules kick in. I'm trying to remember whether the used tax credit kicks in now or in 2023, but it's definitely soon. And there are a bunch of new conditions. The first thing that will perhaps impact some purchases is the old law had a cap of 200,000 vehicles sold by one manufacturer. And after that cap was reached, purchasers of those vehicles could no longer get the tax credit. So Tesla hit that cap a long time ago. Tesla buyers have not been eligible for the $7,500 tax credit for a long time. And GM hit it as well, based on the Volt and the Bolt. So those will be lifted immediately.
Okay.
And then there's all the other manufacturers that hadn't hit that cap yet.
All right. There are also stipulations, John Paul, which might make it more of a challenge to buy EVs. For instance, in the act, there are sourcing requirements. New EVs would need to be assembled in North America, if I've got that right. If that's the case, what is the bandwidth among automakers on this continent to meet the production demands?
Yeah, there's a couple of conditions, and the one you've pointed out first about assembly in North America, certainly not all of the EVs in the market now are being made in North America. The timing of this will coincide well with the fact that General Motors and Ford are about to release a large number of electric vehicles, more or less all of which are built in North America. And so it will immediately provide some incentives towards those domestically built models. Hyundai and Kia have a lot of electric vehicles, and they have plants in the U.S., and so it gives them the incentive to shift their electric vehicle production to their U.S. plants. That would be true of the Japanese manufacturers, the German manufacturers. So there's definitely a goal here by policymakers to bring as much of the manufacturing content, both final assembly and eventually supply chain of other things as well, to America, to North America, as part of a broader strategy to boost U.S. competitiveness and employment in the important manufacturing sector.
So will there be, at least initially in the first few years after this act is signed into law, will there be an issue with supply? Do you see supply ramping up maybe a few years in because some of these, you know, foreign automakers have to shift production to this country?
Yeah, there'll be, I think, a number of factors that may affect supply. Right now, we have supply shortages because of, in some cases, demand is higher than expected. Probably the big thing has been the shortage of semiconductor chips for the auto industry, which has, you know, postponed or delayed a tremendous amount of production of EVs, but also of other vehicles. But with respect to the new legislation, I think that perhaps the battery supply chain conditions may be more of a limiting factor.
Mm-hmm.
What the law says is that you get less of a tax credit if the battery is built outside of North America. You get less of a tax credit if the raw materials in the battery are sourced from a country where the U.S. does not have a fair trade agreement. And this is meant to also accelerate the movement of the supply chain to the U.S. and also to encourage the movement away from, you know, cobalt, for example, comes mostly from countries where there are human rights and child labor abuses associated with the mining of the minerals. So there's a set of policy concerns all bundled together here that may, you know, slow the pickup of this. But these are all, I think, valid policy concerns.
So before we get to the nuts and bolts about buying an EV, just want to talk for a moment about where the U.S. does stand in the domestic sourcing of minerals that are necessary to the construction of EV batteries. I was reading, John Paul, in the Washington Post that a company named Talon Metals is trying to open a nickel mine in Tamarack, Minnesota, and is attempting to convince the locals that nickel mining can be done without creating an environmental mess. Mining has a checkered environmental history, so, you know, domestic sourcing is far from a given.
Yeah, so two things to say. Lithium is the most important mineral in all electric vehicle batteries, regardless of other, you know, aspects of their chemistry depend on lithium. Lithium is actually not in short supply around the world, but there is a shortage of existing capacity of lithium, and so a lot of investment is flooding into that, too. There are places in the U.S., including some interesting, something called the Salton Sea in California, which is a mineral-rich sort of thick liquid, which actually contains a lot of lithium. That's a different way of extraction than some other mining. But with nickel, you're absolutely right. There's a shortage of nickel. There's not much nickel in the U.S. at all right now. There's a fair amount in Canada, but it is a constrained mineral. So two paths forward, I guess. One is to create new sources of nickel, such as the effort you described in Minnesota. The other is to shift the battery chemistries away from nickel and cobalt. And there are some relatively promising developments, and forgive the technical terminology. There's a battery chemistry called LFP for lithium ferrophosphate, lithium, iron, and phosphate. Iron and phosphate are incredibly plentiful. There are a number of other advantages of these batteries in terms of stability, less susceptibility to fire, so on and so forth. They're not quite as powerful as the nickel and cobalt-based battery chemistries, but there's a lot of work going on right now to still leverage that chemistry. Tesla, for example, first in China, but also now in the U.S., is using this LFP chemistry. Volkswagen is getting ready to apply it. Ford is talking about it. So there's a bunch of different ways to kind of crunch this problem and get to some solutions. It's another sign of being at a more, I would say, maturing point, far from mature, but at a stage where we've got more options available.
So a few more years. All right, let's just talk about questions potential buyers have had about EVs. Sure. John Paul, there's something you call range anxiety.
Sure, and this is the worry that you'll run out of juice in your battery and be stuck somewhere, or have to spend a tremendous amount of time, you know, finding a charging station and having it, you know, complicate your life. You know, it's it's a psychological perception, and so it is complicated to change it. I think the kinds of things that may start to change it are several. One is that battery range is way higher. So, you know, upward of 300 miles for a lot of the models that are coming. Just to give a little perspective, average American has about 40 miles a day of vehicle use. And so even in a week, that doesn't quite hit the 300-mile barrier.
It's encouraging.
Charging is a home option for some people, not all, but I just want to have us focus for a moment on the people for whom in a suburban or a rural setting could install essentially the equivalent of what you'd use for an electric dryer as an outlet where you would plug in your vehicle overnight. So if you have done your 40 or 80 miles in a day and come home and charge it overnight, then you're ready with a full battery to, you know, go forth after that. So, and more and more businesses are starting to install chargers. These aren't just going to be at, you know, existing gas stations that then add electric chargers. It's going to be in, you know, a strip mall, a mini mall parking lot. And, you know, I've talked some to the people who are running some of these for-profit charging companies, and they envision a day in which, as you do your errands, you can top off the battery.
How close are we to that day, John Paul? I mean, I'm jumping in just because we've only got about a minute 15 left. When do you envision this infrastructure really set up and ready to roll?
Yeah. Well, we're a long way away, and it will also be uneven. In other words, there'll be more availability in some area, and for some people, cities are going to be tougher. People who live in apartment buildings without dedicated parking, who park on the street, that's what I do in Philly. And, you know, the incentives in the new bill will increase both the private investment but also the government investment in things like charging along the interstate. So I think it's still a hard problem. It's feeling less like an insurmountable problem. It's feeling less like the chicken and egg problem that we've talked about for years, which is no one will buy an EV because they're too worried, and no one will invest in charging because they don't see enough demand. We're well past that. Yeah. So I think it's going to be chipping away and moving the infrastructure forward and paying a lot of attention to equality of accessibility.
So we've got about 15 seconds left. You know, with the Inflation Reduction Act on the verge of being signed into law, if I'm interested in buying an electric car, do I jump now or do I wait a bit to see how the new stipulations pan out?
Yeah, I think if there's a model that you like, it's available now. It may already be covered by the tax credit. I don't see a lot of reason to wait. I think if you wait a little longer, there'll be a lot more different models available in different categories and different price ranges and possibly, you know, more tax credits. What if you buy a used EV? That's coming in a year.
Oh, and by the way, credits for used electric vehicles are expected to go into effect for cars put into service after December 31st of this year. John Paul McDuffie of the Wharton School, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Stay with us as the regional roundup continues.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is the regional roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Over 100,000 people nationwide are on the waiting list for organs, 5,000 in the WHYY listening area alone, and many are individuals who belong to racial or ethnic minority groups. The majority of people in need of an organ transplant are waiting for kidneys, and according to the National Kidney Foundation, Black and Latino Americans are at higher risk for chronic kidney disease and kidney failure. They also tend to wait longer for life-saving organs. At the same time, fewer people in minority communities sign up as potential donors for a variety of reasons, a situation organ procurement organizations such as the Gift of Life are trying to change. August is National Minority Donor Awareness Month, and here with us in studio to tell us more are Rick Hawes, President and CEO of the Gift of Life Donor Program. Welcome, Rick.
Hi, Mary.
And Timmy Nelson underwent a kidney transplant 5 years ago. He is now a patient advocate and Gift of Life ambassador. Welcome to you as well, Timmy.
Thank you, Mary.
You're welcome, both. Organ donation, you know, it's not a comfortable topic for many of us to talk about. But the reality is thousands of people are on transplant lists, literally waiting for a second chance at life. Rick, first to you, describe the very real need for organ donors.
Yeah, Mary, right now in the United States, we have 100,000 patients who are awaiting transplantation. One patient gets added to the list every 20 minutes. And, you know, 20 people each day die waiting for that second chance at life. Here in the Philadelphia area, we have over 5,000 patients who are in need, with the majority of those patients being kidney transplant patients.
Timmy, when did you first realize you were going to need a new kidney?
Mary, my official transplant journey began in January of 2013. I was having a minor surgery, and as a result of that, the surgery turned out fine, but then they determined that I had an issue with my creatinine, which is a measurement of your kidney function. And I found out that my kidneys weren't working very well.
So I'm guessing that was a seismic shift in the way you looked at life. What happened next?
Tell you what, Mary, that was the beginning of a lot of life changes, if you would. Psychological, basically. I learned then that what kidney function really meant to the average person. I also was shocked to find out, and my doctors were shocked to find out, that I was one of those people that had no symptoms. So had they not caught this issue during a routine check, I'm one of those people that would have, as we say, would have crashed into dialysis one day. And one day I would just probably passed out and had to go have dialysis. The great thing about it, though, is having good medical doctors and good medical care, I was able to understand what end-stage renal disease is all about, and I was able to understand what I needed to do to make sure that longevity did not have an end for me right away, at least.
How long were you on the waiting list?
I joined the wait list let me back up a second. I started on dialysis in December of 2013. I joined the wait list in April of 2014. And I received my kidney transplant in July of 2017, so I'm just past 5 years post-transplant.
Yeah, well, that's wonderful news. Why is there a hesitancy, Rick, among some people to register as organ donors?
Yeah, it's a great question, Mary, because we know when we do public polls through the Gallup organization that 95% of the people, when asked, you know, support organ and tissue donation. But when you ask them to register on your driver's license, we're only at about 48 to 49%. And many of the reasons that people give are they just think that they're going to receive some type of different care in the emergency department should they ever be in an accident. You know, one of the urban myths that
less care?
Yeah, less care, and that because all they think they want your organs and they won't try to save your life. And there couldn't be anything more, farther from the truth. It's a separate organization, obviously, Gift of Life from the Emergency Care Department. Yeah. And we're only called after all efforts have been made to save your life. But that's one of the main issues in terms of education. And then finally, it's just some of the distrust of the healthcare system and how can we provide more trust and really to do that through education. And so National Donate. Donate Life Minority Awareness Month here in August, really to dispel some of these myths and to provide people education about donation and transplantation.
I want to get into that some more in just a moment. But Timmy, when you first heard that a kidney was available for you, what went through your mind?
Relief, for starters. I was on peritoneal dialysis, the dialysis I self-administered, and I was doing well with that. However, there's nothing like having an actual kidney functioning where you get up every day, you go about your everyday life and with no constraints, if you would. But it was relief. And also the realization that the opportunity was here to do so, to get that transplant.
Yeah. One, I understand that through the Gift of Life, you received a letter from your donor's family?
I did, Mary. And that was also life-changing, and that impacts me today even. After I had my transplant, Gift of Life coordinated me receiving a letter from my donor's family. I was able to read about her and her lifestyle and what a wonderful young lady she was. And that enhanced my commitment to make sure that I did all I could do to give back, because I think about that family and how they, in their most traumatic time ever probably, they made that most selfless decision to say, let's help someone else. Even with the trauma we're going through right now, let's help someone else, which is why it's so important that we have these discussions and talk about organ donation, the transplant process, because people need to understand how that process truly works and take away some of those myths and misconceptions.
Rick was just talking about mistrust of the medical community, and you know, justifiably, many in the African-American community are distrustful of, you know, edicts perhaps from the medical community. In your work as a Gift of Life ambassador, Timmy, when you talk among friends and family, say, does this ever come up? And if it does, what do you tell them?
Mary, it comes up constantly, to be very frank with you. It comes up constantly. And I found the best approach is to acknowledge the missteps of the past. Let's not pretend those things did not happen. They did happen. But also let's talk about what's happening right now. Let's talk about the number of minorities that are totally involved in the medical field now and have oversight on some of these kind of things. Let's talk about the facts of the issue, not the misconceptions of it.
Yeah. And do you find that people are open to hearing what you have to say?
It is. And I think being transparent is the key.
Yeah. Rick, let's talk about the matching procedure, process, I should say. Are organs matched by racial ethnicity necessarily?
No, they're really not. Most organs are matched first primarily on your blood type and then taking things into consideration such as your size, your tissue type, and how long you've been waiting. All of those things factor in. And then finally, one of the most important one is really how sick you are. For every other organ other than the kidneys, there is some type of sense of urgency because without that organ, you will die. With kidneys, since you have dialysis to keep you going, it's more about how long you've waited. And, you know, Timmy, as he said, waited almost 4 years since the initiation of dialysis. And the average waiting time for a kidney transplant is about 5 years.
Well, according to the National Kidney Foundation, Black transplant candidates tend to wait longer than their white counterparts for kidney, heart, and lung transplants. Rick, can you shed light on this?
Yeah, I think the national system has started really to look at this in a much more robust way. So one of the early matching factors was how long you waited, right, for a kidney. And that time was calculated from the time that you were put on the waiting list. But what we found out was that Black Americans were put on that waiting list much later in their progression of their kidney disease. And so what they when we re-looked at that, we started to a new policy where you were put on the waiting list at the time you initiated dialysis. So if you were referred later in your progression of disease, you were now not, that was taken into account. And so that has helped equalize some of the waiting times, particularly in kidney transplants.
Yeah. Timmy, are you finding that within the community of folks that you were talking to that maybe there's less access to health care, which is why people are maybe later getting into dialysis and then on transplant lists?
Mary, I think it's primarily a lack of knowledge about some things.
Okay.
There's an air of when a medical professional tells you something, you just listen to what they're stating and don't ask me any questions. And that's predominant in the minority community. Yeah. And I can share that from personal experience. However, when I talk with patients, I encourage them to become their own best advocate. You are the captain of your care team, and I encourage people to take charge, ask those questions of medical professionals, and seek the answers.
You say take ownership of their health, the folks who are in need of the transplant. What does that mean, take ownership of your health?
Well, Mary, when you look at the whole transplant process, the dialysis and transplant process, there are certain things medical professionals can do for you. They can provide the medical portion of your care. But however, when you look at transplant process, two big factors are you adhering to your dialysis prescription? That prescription is making sure you're as healthy as possible. Also, are you doing what you need to do for your personal health? So I ask patients to take care of the things that they can manage themselves and let the medical professionals have a fighting chance at getting them to a better situation.
Rick, a question of the moment. The federal government is investigating whether the technology connecting organ procurement organizations is outdated and whether there's been sufficient oversight of communication between OPOs. In your opinion, is there a need to overhaul the system as you work to get organs to patients in a safe and timely fashion?
I wouldn't use the word overhaul, but like any healthcare system, we should be on that continuous quality improvement. And I think there are some opportunities to improve the IT technology so that we can match organs with patients who are waiting much quicker, much faster, much more efficiently, and how we track those organs from the time they leave that donor's operating room until they arrive at the transplant hospital, because we want to be good stewards of that gift. We have a responsibility to those patients who are awaiting transplantation. That's who we work for. And we want to be able to communicate to a donor family that we can do that in the most efficient. We view ourselves as really the shepherds of those gifts for that family because, you know, transplantation and the outcome of the recipients is tremendous. But we don't also want to forget those donor families and the pride and the feeling of being able to create a new legacy for their loved one that donation brings them.
Do donor families, Rick, and recipients sometimes choose to meet?
Yeah, we have a process through our grief counselors. We follow families after donation at periodic intervals, both with personal one-on-one counseling, family counseling, and really advocate for them to begin a letter-writing first process with between the donor family and the recipient, and should they choose to meet down the line, try to arrange for that to happen. But it's fairly rare that actually occurs.
Yeah. Are you in communication with your donor's family, Timmy?
Mary, yes, I am. I tell you, we shared letters a couple times now. It's been a while, but a couple times now. And I have to share with you, that's part of my advocacy, is to make sure that, as Rick stated, seldom do you meet the donor families. But my commitment has been, if I ever have the opportunity to meet my donor's family, I want to be able to stand firm and share with them that she and I have done some great things together.
Yeah, I hear her name was Gwendolyn.
That is correct.
And because of Gwendolyn, Timmy, you were able to walk your daughter down the aisle a couple of years
that
back.
That is so true, Mary. You know, and we talk about the trauma patients go through when they're diagnosed, and I share with people my first thought was, would I be able to walk my daughter down the aisle? Well, even in the throes of the pandemic, April 1st of 2020, I was able to do that.
Oh, that's something. So you are registered, Timmy, as an organ donor years before it was determined you needed a new kidney. What prompted you to sign up?
Mary, I tell you, when I moved to Pennsylvania, my job transferred me here. When I moved here, I was at the DMV. And as I was about to leave the DMV, they asked me, would you like to be an organ donor? I must confess, I'd never had that question posed to me in any of the states I lived in.
Did it take you aback a little bit? Or?
It didn't take but a second, to be honest with you, because it dawned on me that if my last gift, my parting gift to this world when my time comes to go, is to do something that can support someone else, to me that was the quote-unquote no-brainer.
Rick, how many lives can one organ donor potentially save?
Sure. One organ donor can help really up to 8 different organ recipients. But the donation of tissues, such as skin, corneas, heart valves, tendons, can help up to 100. So it's an amazing gift.
Who might be ineligible to donate? Which types of medical conditions might preclude donation?
Yeah, really right now, Mary, the only thing that will rule you out is active metastatic cancer. Through the HIV HOPE Act, we're actually transplanting HIV-positive organs into HIV-positive recipients. Conditions such as hepatitis C, we try to match with hepatitis C candidates, or with some really new research, we're able to transplant hepatitis C organs into non-hepatitis C recipients and then cure them with the new drugs for hepatitis C. So a lot of interesting research, but really the only absolute rule out right now would be metastatic cancer, and that would be just for organs. You know, things such as corneas, since the cornea has very little blood supply, can still be utilized from patients who die of cancer.
So COVID, no issue here?
COVID has always been an issue for, as you well know, for the last 2.5 years. And I think early on, we scrambled like everybody else to be able to test donors. And initially was a rule out. But now as we've learned more about the disease and learned more about the vaccination process and understanding it, it's no longer an absolute rule out for donation. And it really depends upon that cycle of where that disease is at when that person dies.
Timmy, if one of our listeners who is tuning in right now and was kind of on the bubble about registering to become an organ donor, what would you say to them?
I would share with them that here's an opportunity for you to provide service to someone else before your time may come. You know, we talk about service, and what I mean by that is that most major religions have total support for organ donation. So if a person had a question about that, I would ask them to talk with their religious leader, talk with their family, talk with their friends to get some comfort in that decision. But in most cases, they're going to find that most major religions support that totally. Here's a great opportunity for you to have a parting gift for your fellow person.
Rick, there's also something called living donation, in which a donor can offer one of their kidneys or, I know, part of a liver. Who is best equipped to be a living donor? I mean, do you necessarily have to be a young adult, for instance?
You don't have
to. Is this something that your group handles, Gift of Life?
Yeah, we don't necessarily handle directly a living donation. We do help out with some of the preservation of the organs and some of the transportation. But to be a living donor, you really just really need to have good health. But there have been donors in well into their 70s to become living donors. We had a woman who was in her mid-60s walk by our office and see a sign about donation and then made a decision to donate into a chain in which she donated into this chain, and then that person donated to the next person, and it ended up transplanting over 14 people.
Wow.
Just from seeing a sign and being an altruistic donor. So,
great story.
It's a really an amazing gift.
Timmy, very quickly, you're quoted as saying, every time I address a group of patients, whether it's for transplant or dialysis, I also share with folks, I'm not doing this by myself. Referring to your donor here?
Very much so, Mary. Gwendolyn and I are trying to do some great work, and we hope we're making an impact for the world.
All right. Timmy Nelson, patient advocate and Gift of Life ambassador, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Rick Haas, president and CEO of the Gift of Life Donor Program. Our pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, Mary.
All right. Stay with us as the regional roundup continues. We'll talk to gardening expert Jenny Rose Carey. That's next.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Welcome back. A second brutal heat wave is in the rearview mirror, and as temperatures moderate, many of us who like to garden have been heading back outside. The aftermath of the extreme heat is evident. Browned out lawns, exhausted hydrangeas, wilting patio plants, and more. So how do we best revive plants stressed by scorching temperatures, and what can we do to plan ahead, knowing that heat events increasingly will be a part of life? We're going to ask these questions and also talk about the art and science of developing a flower garden with Jenny Rose Carey, gardener, educator, and author. Jenny's newest book is called The Ultimate Flower Gardener's Guide, and she joins us now from the United Kingdom. Welcome back, Jenny. Thanks for jumping to time zones for us.
Oh, thank you for having me back, Mary. I always love to be on your show.
Oh, we love to have you with us. So before we get to the Philadelphia area, you know, Western Europe is just coming out of another major heat wave. Describe what's happening in the UA and two area gardens where you are right now.
So I'm actually in the Peak District, which is in the sort of middle to the north of England. And we have just had a long weekend of very hot temperatures for over here. So it would be in the 80s and 90s, which doesn't sound much, but we're staying in a little cottage. And of course, there might be one fan, but there's no air conditioning or anything. So you just, you know, they're not used to it over here. So people have been, you know, going outside and trying to find some water to get into, as everyone in Philadelphia has. So,
well, regardless of where we are, what sorts of damage can prolonged higher heat do to a plant that's not built for extreme temperatures, Jenny?
Well, we call it the permanent wilting. It means it's dead. But, you know, if it gets too desiccated and dried out. So as we know, the water comes up through the roots. And if the soil gets too dry, it can't pull up enough water into it. And first signs might be on a tree, early dropping of leaves, which I saw before I left home. So the leaves start to drop and, you know, maybe other bits turn brown or yellow or something like that. So that's one symptom. On trees and shrubs that are established, I wouldn't worry too much. And obviously lawn, we say don't bother to water that. That will come back, even though it looks pretty dreadful. The things to save your precious water for would be your container plants, things like a hanging basket or a, you know, anything grown in a pot, annuals and vegetables, particularly your tomatoes or tomatoes, because if you don't water them, they won't, you know, give you any fruit and the fruit won't bulk up. Yeah. So that would be where you put your precious water if you have a limited amount. Things that really do well would be drought tolerant plants of any sort. So things that come from the warmer areas of the earth, and things like Mediterranean plants like lavender, those do well. And that's really what horticulturists are trying to get people to do, is think about, especially in your further areas away from a watering can or a hose, plant more of those sort of things.
You have a garden you planted in 2004 that you have not watered since?
I know. It's a drought-tolerant garden. So in 2003, I went to the south of France and saw lavender growing like I had never seen it growing before so well. And so I thought, oh, okay, so I'm being too nice to my lavender, because I had a nice herb garden. So I put this garden in primarily to grow lavender and other drought-tolerant plants. Plus, I'm a scientist, so I really wanted to see what I could grow in the Philadelphia area without extra water. So we plant them, we give them a, you know, bucket of water when they go in, and then they're on their own, and we don't rescue them.
You don't rescue. You have to resist the temptation to try to, quote, rescue them.
Yes, quote, rescue, yes.
So you write in your book that when planting a garden, we should consider the amount of precipitation we get and other available water sources. As temperatures trend upward and we can expect more waves of high or extreme heat, Jenny, how do we factor all this in, especially if the occurrence of these weather events is kind of uneven?
Well, that's a really good question, and it's sort of occupying all of us in the industry right now, because we don't know whether we're going to get the extreme floods and we don't know whether we're going to get the extreme drought. So, you know, some people use the global weirding expression, which I think is probably what we should expect, the unexpected. But yeah. Philadelphia has always been like that. I've gardened there for 35 years and it's always been odd. I think it's just odder. So what I like to do is put things on berms or banks and decide by looking them up whether they need more water or less. So if they need more, I'm talking about perennials here primarily, just to keep it simple. Mm-hmm. But if they need more, I put them down the bottom of the bank. If they need less, like a lavender or a lavender cotton or a sea holly, they would go up on the top.
That makes sense.
I think it really works. And also then you can play with the direction. You know, if it's facing north in our climate, in our latitude, then you can put some of the more shade tolerant ones on the north bank. And then on the sunny south bank, you can put all your real sort of Mediterranean things that love the sun.
And speaking of shading, you told our producer, Paige, that you know of people who put umbrellas over their peonies. I mean, I guess that's it.
I had a lovely neighbor who she'd like protect things from the sun with like a parasol. She had antique parasols, but yeah, if you really want to protect things, yeah,
that's
extreme measures.
All right, so prepping the soil can also guard against plant loss when the heat arises. As far as the soil is concerned, what do you suggest? How do you amend it?
So depending where you live, if you garden down the shore, you need more of this really, because sandy soil, really the water flows through really quickly, as we know, whereas if you're on clay, it does tend to retain soil water for longer. But actually the interesting thing is both types of soil benefit from added organic matter. I know we say it all the time, but if you have either, if you can save your leaves, or if your township has the municipal composting, go and get some of that. Or you can use, you know, I don't recommend peat moss because it's only a limited resource, but if you can find something made from seaweed or especially any organic matter, so leaf mold, compost, and that sort of thing, add that into the soil. You don't have to do it all at one time. What I do it is use it as a soil improver by putting it on the surface. So I actually, you know, spring and autumn mostly, I just keep adding a bit more onto the top, and then usually the soil organisms take it down, and over time it improves your soil.
Interesting.
And that organic matter acts like a sponge as it decomposes. So the soil organisms break that organic matter down, and it actually can hold like 80% of its weight in water or something like that. So it actually really, really helps hold water into the soil.
And it's less work if you just kind of
pile
it on.
Yes, you don't have to dig it in.
Love it.
We're doing a lot more of just add to the top and have done with it. But if you leave the soil naked with no mulch on top, then water evaporates. So I have different areas that I use inorganic mulches like gravels and grits, and some that I use the compost or leaf mold on top of.
So we've had some beautiful weather the last few days here in the Delaware Valley, Jenny. And for those of us who are getting a second wind and heading back out into the garden and are tempted to put something in now for fall plantings, I mean, is mid-August a good idea, or should we wait a little bit?
Okay, what you should be doing right now is planning for in a couple of weeks. So it's a little early to be putting much in because we could get more heat and drought in the next couple of weeks. But really, you're planning for after Labor Day when it, you know, miraculously does seem to cool down a bit and we get a few autumn rains usually. So I would highly recommend ordering your spring flowering bulbs now. So things like daffodils, tulips, things like the glory of the snow, crocus, all of those different ones. This is a really good time to order them online or go to your garden center, see what they have in, if they have anything in by now, but soon they'll be coming in. And plan what you might want to do. It could be in pots, it could be in the ground. And I always say try and do something outside the door that you use most often, because even if you buy 10 daffodils, 10 tulips, and a few little crocus and put them right outside your door, then you have something to welcome you home in the spring.
So let's talk about developing a flower garden for the person who hasn't done this before, the prospect of creating something that looks good, that's beautiful, might be a little bit intimidating. What is the very first step, Jenny?
Well, I always start with a flower wish list. And the reason I start with that is because you get a few gardeners in a room or non-gardeners that want to be gardeners, and their opinions differ right away. So I start with a list, and that can be done by books or magazines or online or visiting some of our lovely public gardens. We have 35 public gardens in the Philadelphia area. If you go on to the America's Garden Capital website, and you can find all of those ones, and some of them are free. So go to gardens right now, see what they have, and don't get overwhelmed by it. If you go to the big gardens, it's all too easy to get just way overwhelmed.
Yeah.
What I would like you to do is pick one or two flowers that you like the best and try and find their names out. And if you go to a public garden, they may be labeled, or you could ask a gardener or go with your, you know, friendly neighbor that gardens.
And they could be in Latin too.
They could be in Latin.
A little challenging for some of us.
I know, but don't let that worry you. In the book, I actually arranged the flowers by Latin. It's so easy to cross-reference them. And the reason I did that is because then you can talk to any gardener in any area of the country or any country. Because if I come to gardens over here and start saying the American common names for things, often they differ.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of like the universal language. And you don't have to learn all of them at once, but it's sort of like a fun way to keep your brain active. Just think of it like that. But the key to planning your garden is start with your wish list and divide it by seasons. So go back to that same flower bed that you loved over and over again, so that you will see what in a, you know, a professional setting in a public garden, they do with that same bed, because you will see the rotation of the seasons. I have a whole chapter on seasonal gardening because it's just so fascinating how you can use that same space over and over again, and different things can pop up through the other ones.
But start small, you say.
Yes. Oh, yes. Definitely start small. That's why I always go to the little garden outside the door, because either by your patio or your front door, wherever you tend to be, and really make, I call it like a jewel box, like a little boutique garden. And you don't need many things, but you need different shapes and in your preferred sort of color range.
So, and you say that color in the garden has been a divisive issue for generations, with certain hues and combinations going in and out of fashion. Tell us more about that, Jenny.
Oh, my goodness. I love this topic. I mean, it really is fascinating. So one of my gardening heroines was Gertrude Jekyll, and she was an English flower gardener, and she was one of the first people to get gardeners to really think of flower colour in an artistic way, and she disliked the colour magenta. So I love magenta, so Gertrude and I really differ on that. We agree on many other things. But then you talk to somebody else and they say, oh, I love blue in the garden. And somebody else says, oh, I wouldn't garden without red. So colour seems to be a preference thing.
Whereas
personal. Shape, very personal. That's a good way of saying it. Whereas shape, if you ask people who design gardens, having a variety of different shapes of plants and flowers really adds to the interest and diversity in your flower bed. So go for a differing variety of shapes, and then choose the colors in the one that you like.
So for those of us who have already gotten started and realize that we put plants we love in the wrong place, we like to move them around. How risky is it to move plants once they've established and they've gotten big?
Oh my goodness, you can go for it. Just go for it. People ask me, when is the best time to move it? I say, when you've got a shovel in your hand is when I say. But, you know, if it's after a rain, so if you wait till after rain, or if you water the bed deeply, and as I say, in the next few weeks, you'll be able to move it. It's interesting. You know how the water at the shore stays warm for a long time, you know, after Labor Day?
Yep.
So the soil water stays warm. So the autumn or the fall is a really good time to move things. So dig up the hole, you know, in the same way as the water in the ocean stays warm. So the air might cool, but the ground is still nice and warm for root establishment. So dig up the whole clump. And if you want to divide it, now is a good time, you know, coming into September. And if you can't pull it apart with your hands, you get a couple of forks, or you dig the fork into the middle, or use an old bread knife. That's really a good way to cut up like a daylily or something like that. And often you'll reinvigorate things, or you can do a plant swap with your friends or neighbors.
So not as risky as we might fear.
No, just go for it. I mean, if you didn't like it where it was and you kill it, oh well, is what I say.
You also give advice, Jenny, on freshening the garden up a bit. I mean, after we've done all that work, if we were to have visitors. Got about 30 seconds.
Okay, I love that. You just go along with your scissors, cut out anything that looks brown, maybe sort of fluff up everything, tie a few things up. And if you need to go to the garden center, you may not even need to plant it. Just buy something in flower and plop it right in the flower bed and you're done.
You say, Jenny, that gardening teaches us to be optimists. We'll leave on that
note. Yes. Okay. Thank you, Mary.
Thank you.
Nice to talk to you.
Oh, as always, nice to talk to you. Jenny Rose Carey, her new book is called The Ultimate Flower Gardener's Guide. Thanks, Jenny.
Bye.
And don't forget, you can find today's show at whyy.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez is our engineer, our producer, Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks so much for joining us. Be well.